Hello and welcome to the Smart Beauty Podcast. I'm your host, Viola Levy, beauty journalist and founder of copy-led branding agency, Smart Beauty Creative. We're here to create your brand voice and craft the story behind it. Today, I'm talking to the amazing Sarah McCartney. She has graced this podcast before, so you can go back and listen to the episode I did with her talking about her range for 160 Tuesdays. She is a perfumer, so that was a really interesting chat, and she has so many amazing insights and opinions about the fragrance industry, and is a fountain of knowledge. So I do suggest checking out that episode if you haven't already. We'll include a link in the show notes. But today she has kindly joined us to talk about Lush. So before she started her own brand, earlier on in her career, she was the editor of the Lush Times, which I fondly remember as a student getting very excited when it dropped through my letterbox. This was pre-social media days. And today she is talking about a new collection that Lush have launched called the Lush Version. Slightly provocative, well, not even slightly, rather provocative and controversial. It focuses on the Body Shop's bestsellers that Mark Constantine, I have to pronounce that correctly as I was saying Constantine, which Sarah pulled me up about. Apparently he gets very angry as well if you mispronounce his name. I have to bear that in mind if I ever meet him. Anyway, Mark Constantine created this range because he used to work with Anita Roddick and her husband at the Body Shop, and he formulated all of these products. So you could argue that he has a prior claim, but given that he is now with Lush, his own brand, and the Body Shop are still going, they were recently acquired by the Aurea Group and have a new CEO. So it's very exciting times for them. So it's a very interesting move from Lush. Some would say quite a controversial one. So Sarah is here to provide her insights and opinions, having been a member of the Lush team and having worked with Mark Constantine herself. She was one of the only previous Lush team members to have not signed an NDA, so she can speak a bit more freely than some others who have worked there. I was very excited to hear what she had to say and really enjoyed this chat, and I hope you will too. So thank you so much, Sarah, for joining me once again on the podcast, and really looking forward to chatting with you, as I'm sure you've got a lot to say on this topic. So Lush have recently launched a new range called the Lush Version, which is, they say in no uncertain terms, it's a fresh take on the Body Shop's treasured favourites. And basically, for those who aren't aware, Mark Constantine created a lot of these products while he was working with the Body Shop, or co-created them, should we say. So he does have a claim that he's not, you know, they were the products that he created. And he, you know, one could argue that he should be kind of celebrating his legacy, but the Body Shop is still going. And that is why people have kind of raised a few eyebrows, because arguably, you know, it's still a rival brand, which is still in business. And when you look on the website, what they've sort of said about it, it is kind of taking swipes in no uncertain terms, talking about how customers felt betrayed when the Body Shop was sold to L'Oreal. They say the Body Shop never recovered from its former glory. And I was like, well, give it a chance. It's still going. It could still recover. And a change of ownership ultimately couldn't revive the heart and soul and quality of a brand once loved by so many, which, yeah, not exactly awash with ambiguity. And I wanted to chat to you because obviously you worked at Lush, you were the editor of the Lush Times and worked closely with Mark and the founding team. So I'd really love to get your thoughts, because obviously it's quite, you know, we all love a bit of industry theatre, but do you think this is more of, this is an interesting move, and that Mark has a right to celebrate the products that he arguably created, or do you think it's not really in keeping with the Lush ethos? Like, what are your initial thoughts?
Knowing them as I do, I would say this is entirely 100% consistent with the way the Constantine family always felt about the Body Shop and the end of their relationship with them, and even from the beginning of their relationship with them, right through to the point at which Nita Roddick sold to L'Oreal, and onwards after that. So I was involved in all of that time. So I can tell you a number of things that came up, which would indicate, I mean, this just did not surprise me the slightest little bit.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's as you only have to mention Anita Roddick. It's Constantine, by the way. And that was one of the things that kept coming up. When people called him Constantine, he also used to slightly get annoyed. So just so you know, it's Constantine.
Good to know in case I ever meet him. Thanks for the heads
yeah,
up.
Yeah, just in case. I'm not surprised. There's a lot of stored, bottled up rage about what happened between the Lush founders who were supplying products for the body shop.
I can imagine.
Until a certain point at which it all fell apart, which I can also tell you about because I'm one of the few people who got out and didn't sign an NDA. This all comes from a genuine, powerful knowledge, belief, and it's that they know that they were right about this. They're absolutely certain that they're doing the right thing. Otherwise, they wouldn't do it. They know it's. They're probably. They will have discussed. Is it a good idea? And a lot of people around will say, "Oh, I don't think so." And they would have gone, "Well, you know what? I'm doing it anyway because what they've done to this brand is an outrage, and it's not fair. And we're doing it." Words to that effect. I think would have happened.
And also, I think you mentioned that the ingredients they're using are much higher quality, whereas the Body Shop kind of diluted them to get the cheapest version that they could, and Lush is kind of bringing that quality element back.
Yeah, what's actually happened, I'm pretty sure, although obviously I wasn't in the room, but looking at the picture of the product, the Lush version, it's evident that there are actually bananas in it again. And suddenly, like dawn, while we're talking, I was thinking to myself, oh, of course, this is the original formulas, which they fell out of use because the original formulas that Lush made were made with fresh fruit and all the naturals that they could squeeze into them to try and get the best effect. And of course, over the years, Body Shop, the original, kept that formula. But over the years, these things have been tweaked, looked at, changed, altered, such that Body Shop, the name, the brand name remains the same, but actually what they stood for when the Lush guys were making the products, that's completely different. So the fact that these formulas were in effect lost, I mean, the real genuine products had been lost. So I think what's happened is that taking the originals, the very originals, remaking those, it's not even the same product at all. In fact, it's miles away product-wise. And I think that the Constantines are going to be going, right, this is what the Body Shop ought to be. Whoever you are who's bought it, you need reminding of what the Body Shop actually stood for and the quality that the product had. And so we're just going to show you how it's done. We're chatting and once this happened once before, and it was coming up to 2020 when everybody suddenly had to declare the product ingredients on the label, and that hadn't happened before. And Lush was saying, coming up to that point, we were going to be crossing the line into the new millennium, and the products, the ingredients list, the QI lists, Lush were already listing all the fruit and veg and essential oils they're going to put in there. And they said, just wait till people start reading what's actually in the Body Shop, because the obsession is not new. Then wait till they start reading the ingredients list, then have a look at them, and then they'll think, aha, that's the difference. The Lush products are way superior. But actually, nobody really looks and nobody really notices. And that was a big disappointment to them. You know, 2001, it's like, actually, nobody reads ingredients lists. But they were hoping that there'd be a, you know, clear blue sky, is it? Clear blue water, whatever, a big gap, that people would notice the big gap between what Lush was actually doing with the products and what the Body Shop had done with the products. And I begin to suspect that what's actually in it, the quality of it, is the most important thing to them. And it's just realizing, of course, they put the bananas back in. They've actually gone back to the genuine original, really expensive, really difficult to make, have to be made by hand, you know, genuine natural materials. And I think that's way more important than the IP. And everyone's obsessing about the IP. How dare they, you know, how dare they, in effect, encroach upon the Body Shop's IP? But it's more about the quality of the products. That's what finally I think this is all about.
It is a kind of dodgy legal territory. I mean, they might feel like they have that moral high ground, and which many people will agree, but they're not even you know, being subtle about it. They're like, yeah, this is the Body Shop. We did these products, and we're gonna make our versions of what our rival brand, the sort of products that made our rival brand's name. And arguably, I was going to say that they are kind of iconic, not just because they're great products, but because of the brand that Anita Roddick built. That's what kind of made them the icons they are today. So yeah. I think for them to sort of claim that they are kind of now under the Lush umbrella is a little bit unfair in that respect. Would you agree?
Well, I would imagine that when they decided to do this, it looked like the Body Shop was ended and finished forever. And so they thought, right, we'll take it forwards, they're gone. And then by the time the products are ready to come out, the Body Shop hadn't gone. It's lingering, we'll see what happens. And so they thought, well, we'll do it anyway. I'll give you a little bit of background, which was, I mean, there's much, but when Anita Roddick sold to L'Oreal, I mean, Mark was incensed. There was steam coming out of his ears for months. And he decided that because they'd developed Ice Blue shampoo, because when they first started working together, Body Shop didn't have a factory. They didn't make any products. They bought in products. And they bought in products which were made by the team, which then went on to form Cosmetics To Go and then went on to form Lush. When Princess Diana came to visit, they bought themselves a new lab, but they didn't have anything in it. So they had to bring in the whole Lush team with a load of equipment to make some stuff in front of her to make it look like they were actually manufacturing. So it's not as simple as somebody said, oh, Mark was working for Body Shop. It wasn't. They presented products. They developed the top-selling products that the Body Shop did. And then the Body Shop marketed them as their own. Mark maintains that Anita Roddick wasn't the slightest bit interested in animal testing, for example, until they brought that principle with them and told her, you should do this. It's really important. And she went, yeah, okay. Because before that, Mark had worked with Beauty, was it called Beauty Without Cruelty? BWC, this kind of 1970s cruelty-free brand. Mark had worked with them. Anita Roddick hadn't heard of it. The non-animal testing thing was, you know, according to the Constantines, they introduced her to that idea. She thought, oh, that sounds good. And took it on. So there's a lot of what Lush people did that informed where the Body Shop stood and what everybody knew about it. So anyway, they had made Ice Blue shampoo. On the day the sale was announced, Mark said he was going to make a product called Ice Blue for you. And that would be indicative of his feeling that he could, that Anita Roddick could actually go and sell the brand to the people who were doing more animal testing than the rest of Europe's cosmetics companies put together at that time. He was, like I say, he was incandescent. he was uncalmable. He wanted to turn the whole front page of the Lush Times black, which actually he did because I was away for one meeting and I came back. He printed the whole Lush Times with a black front page. And of course, nobody in the shop picked it up and the sales went down. But that was kind of, that was less important to him than making a statement about it, because that was something he genuinely believed in. And
going to say, was it more that he was angry on principle, or was it more that she'd thrown his brand under the bus and his name by doing that?
Oh, no, that was, they'd separated a long time before that. I could tell you about that if you like. But it was...
So there was already bad blood, you're saying?
Oh, yeah. Okay, history. So the body shop was set up when Anita Roddick had been to San Francisco and had seen a shop called The Body Shop, which had wooden floors, green packaging. They refilled the bottles and it was kind of very hippie. And she thought her big business idea was, oh, I know, I'll do that in England. So that's why they couldn't open, the body shop couldn't have a US company. They were in Canada, but they couldn't work in the US for a long time because the brand Body Shop was owned by the two women who established the actual original body shop. So that became quite a difficult time for them. They wanted to do something in the US. So Gordon Roddick, Anita's husband, asked Mark Constantine, because they were working together at the time, and the Constantines, their company with the Constantines with Liz Weir at the time, who went on to form Cosmetics to Go and then Lush. They were working very closely together, making lots of products for the body shop.
Formulators at the time.
Yeah, but also manufacturers.
Yeah.
But yes, they had a company called Constantine and Weir. Mark Constantine and Liz Weir, his business partner, they were manufacturing. They were also formulating, but they started off by doing the manufacturing. So their formulas were like top bestsellers, the body butters, the ice blue shampoo. They were consistently number like 1, 2, 3 in the body shop's best-selling list. So this made it a bit of an odd relationship because the Lush team, as they are now, they owned the formulas. Body Shop did not own the formulas. Their top-selling products, they did not have the intellectual property for. So there they were, unable to go into the US. And Gordon Roddick said to Mark, do you want to go into partnership? We can open a shop in Seattle. And they called this shop Bodkins. They went over, they put a lot of products in, they opened it up. And at the launch party, I quote Mark, he said to Gordon, so is Anita not coming? And Gordon Roddick said to Mark, oh, I haven't told her about this yet. Well, anyway, the thing did not succeed. Well, Gordon Roddick set up a business with Mark Constantine. He hadn't told his wife.
Why hadn't he not told his wife?
Well, he didn't, in case she didn't like the idea. So he did it anyway.
Oh, okay.
So this is where the difficulty started, is that then Gordon got back home and said, oh, by the way, Mark Constantine made me set up a business in Seattle and I've lost all of this much money. And so she was absolutely fuming. And in order for them to stay married, and I mean, obviously I speculate, but I got this. This was a story that Mark told, that Gordon had to blame him. Otherwise, his situation would have been not possible to continue. So
domestic situation, you mean?
Domestic situation, yeah. And so for that reason, they then didn't speak. So then the body shop. It was quite messy. But anyway, so Bodkins was that shop which started and failed in a very short period of time, I think. And they both of them had put in £200,000 each, Mark said. And I have a memory for facts. Okay, so, I mean, I left 14 years ago, but some of these things Lush is so full of drama and gossip all the time that all of these things seem so important that they stuck in my memory. But that was the kind of parting. So at that point, the body shop offered to buy out Constantine and Weir, to buy the formulas from them and separate. So they sold those original formulas. So that was the point at which these formulas that the Lush team, as they are now, had developed, those then changed hands and went to the body shop. Now, they're not the same formulas because you can't use exactly the same things.
No, because of legal regulations changing over the years.
Things will have changed. But I'm sure they'd be very similar. And so then they lost those, the rights to all of those formulas. They went with Body Shop. Now, on a tiny, tiny level, I've had that happen to me. Somebody bought a formula from me and then discovered that they couldn't afford to reproduce it at big quantities and just reformulated, make somebody something completely different. And people come to me and say, oh, but I really used to like that one. I go, can't make it. Can't make it. It's not mine. I sold it. And it really drives me nuts. So that's on a tiny, tiny, tiny scale. So I imagine when a whole load of your formulas get bought and then are unable to be produced, intellectual property doesn't take as big a role as emotional input. When you've been through all of these dramas with somebody and you've lost stuff and you think it should be yours, that's why I think they do it. I don't think they're doing it in any kind of cynical business way. They don't need that.
That's what I thought. And given like Lush's ethos, that they you know, they seem very much like this sort of hippy dippy brand, that, not, you know, for lack of a better phrase, but they, you know, it doesn't seem in keeping with their kind of their spirit, that it's kind of,
they are driven by what they think is right for, mostly for the planet and animals, not necessarily for individuals who have a different idea from them about what they ought to be doing, but they are driven by what they think is going to be the greater good for the planet, the animals and the plants on it, and the Constantine family. That's the constant drive. But and there was a document once, I think I shredded it, I wish I kept it, but Mark wrote a document called Why Lush is a Legendary Company, and he spent quite a lot of time on it, and it describes how he believed that every single cosmetics company pretty much he'd set up after he started had copied them in some way, and so that Lush is singularly responsible for every brand following that to have copied them. Now, there are a lot, you know, the solid shampoo bar, without doubt, that's a thing now, it's all over the place, but they invented it.
Yeah.
The bath bomb, they invented it. And so there are lots of companies who don't even know that they are that's inspired by or copied Lush. And they were so inventive, but there are some other things which it's perfectly possible, as I know and others know, when you start making things, somebody else makes pretty much exactly the same thing as you're just developing in your lab. They don't know you, you don't know them,
it's
and they come out at the same time. And you might both have got your inspiration from the same place.
Yeah.
But I think that, I mean, some things happened in Lush meetings sometimes where they'd be like, oh, we've developed this brand new product and we're going to call it this. And there's one particular one where Mary, head of press, has had to kind of put her hand up and say, that's an Estee Lauder trademark. That's their biggest new skincare brand. How do you not know? And they just didn't go to the shops. So they would get inspiration from lots of other places, but not from anybody else's product ever. So sometimes they had an inspiration for a product, and it already existed. But that used to occur in meetings. Sometimes we'd have to talk them down.
Because Mark and Elizabeth Weir, they were real trailblazers when you think about it in that sense, that they did invent these products that now are kind of ubiquitous on the shelves, and they were the pioneers behind it. But then I'd argue that why not just celebrate that legacy as opposed to directly ripping off the Body Shop? It just feels like it's beneath them, given beneath Lush, given, you know, the amazing brand that they've built. They could just be celebrating the legacy of their founder in a more, I guess, classy way than what they're doing at the moment.
There were a lot of things that could have happened that would have indicated the very much more emotional side. Like, forget about the IP. This is what's important. A lot of things didn't happen that could have happened when we used to have the big creative team meetings. And if it was like, there'd be 40 people in the room, you know, and if it was 39-1 and Mo actually turned around to Mark and said, really, no, you can't do this, he might not do it.
And
but
Mo
if
is
it was
Mark's
only
wife.
Like Mark's wife, Mo Constantine, the inventor of the bath bomb. He truly believes that Mo is the most creative person on the planet. And also the best writer. The only reason they employed me was because Mo was busy. So, I mean, there is this, you kind of have to understand if you want to work with the Lush team that they do honestly think that they are powerhouse creatives like no one else. And they have the proof, you know, but they don't really need other people. It's just annoyingly they have to employ other people because they're busy.
I've worked at companies like that. It's founder syndrome, where the founding team are placed kind of on a higher plane of worthiness to the rest of us. We're just lucky to kind of be within their aura, shall we say. Would you say that?
And if you understand that, then you can kind of toddle on. I know people who were there before me who are still there and you know, fit nicely in with that. I was a bit too much of a, I think that's not right. But if you were, there was the phrase, out of the room, out of the deal. If I missed one meeting, then I'd come back and find something I'd done had been completely rewritten in a way I think, don't publish that. Oh, too late. But I mean, I got lots of marks once when I'd come up with this headline about Easter. And so there was an Easter bunny product that they'd made, and I wrote on it, the headline was "Take the Bunny and Run." This happened to coincide with Anita Roddick selling to L'Oreal. Now, this was separate, but Mark thought it was the most brilliant thing I'd ever done, because he thought I was talking about the Buav non-animal testing bunny and Anita Roddick taking the money. It was coincidence. I was happy to sit back quietly and nod and say, oh yeah, great. But I didn't write it because Anita Roddick had sold to L'Oreal. I wrote it because it was Easter and there was a bunny bath ballistic. So
happy coincidence.
But
you think she went in with the best intentions? It wasn't a case of just taking the bunny and running, as you would say.
Exactly. And I heard this directly from Mark Constantine, who had been told by Gordon Roddick, after Anita died, they spoke again. And he told Mark that he thought she'd basically died of a broken heart, that she got to L'Oreal for her first meeting and they said, I'm sorry, you're not invited. Now, this is two stages of hearsay, of course. So Gordon got it from Anita, who turned up for the meeting. She came home absolutely devastated, because she thought she was being invited in to give them all of her expertise and change the way L'Oreal did everything. And they pretty much wanted ownership of the L'Oreal, of the Body Shop brand, you know. And obviously L'Oreal don't own it any longer, but then it's gone on. The message has sort of been watered down every time it gets bought.
So it wasn't kind of a lack of integrity on Anita Roddick's part. She was just maybe a bit naive and perhaps misled by thinking that L'Oreal were going to do something good, and actually it was a lot more
simple. She was flattered into it. She was convinced that she was going to be the great animal savior, you know, that she had a huge ego. I mean, just without shadow of a doubt, I mean, from other situations long before I joined Lush, I worked with people who had encountered her, and she sidelined people at events. It was, she had this, I don't know, well, she was particularly egocentric. I think
there's
you
an
have to
argument
be
that
to
you
build it.
can't, that's kind of unavoidable if you're going to be a founder or a key, sort of key figure. There's an element of narcissism, isn't there, within that?
Yeah, a founder that's going to drive anything that massive, I think, does have the narcissism. But she, I don't think they found it difficult to convince her that they would take her on and she could change everything for them. But that's not what they wanted, according to Jordan, according to Mark.
That's really sad. And I guess it's a sad ending given everything that she and Mark had built with regards to that. But going back to what you were saying about how Lush feels so strongly about their environmental principles, I think another thing that people are shocked about is that they're using the same plastic tubs for like the body butters as the Body Shop. And you think, well, why are they not, using more sustainable packaging if that's the case? Because they are just.
They'll be recycled.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is that it's very easy to go, oh, plastic. The plastic argument is very, very, very complicated. I mean, there's use on plastic packaging on food, for example, means that food will last 5-10 times longer. You can fill the packaging if it's sealed. You can fill it with nitrogen instead of oxygen so that there's far, far less food waste. And yet you've got knee-jerk reactions about, oh, we've got to get rid of all the plastic because it's plastic. And leading to massive worldwide food waste. So saying, oh, but look, it's plastic, it's a very, very easy low-hanging fruit point to judge people on. But Lush have used recycled plastic for their packaging ever since it was available. And that was when I was there. So that was before 2010.
Yeah, but given that the packaging that they normally use is very different, you kind of think, why wouldn't they just use the same packaging that they've, or similar packaging to what they've always been using? Because clearly they think that that's a more sustainable choice.
Don't know. Can only speak to the past. Can't really speak to the present. But I think they will definitely have looked for the most sustainable option. You know, there's some what looks like plastic I've got here that I'm testing for a perfume for somebody. It looks like plastic. It isn't. It's biodegradable to all intents and purposes. You'd just think, oh, it's a plastic bottle. It's not. We're doing stability tests on that at the moment. It's manufactured in Spain. It's not plastic, but it looks and feels like plastic. So maybe if we ask, it'll turn out to be that.
Yeah, because there are so many better alternatives. I mean, not to just derail the conversation, but things like aluminium, for example, and obviously like the waterless solutions as well is another avenue. But yeah, I just thought that was interesting, really, that they would use the original. Kind of, they would copy the packaging as well as use the formulations.
That's a point, the IP point. Yeah, I mean, I genuinely don't know what it's made. I haven't seen the products. I've only, not in real life, I've only seen pictures of them. So I don't know what the actual source is.
Yeah.
But I would doubt very much that Lush would just go out and buy plastic. I mean, I know they wouldn't.
Yeah.
They just wouldn't. They just can't. It's not in their
No.
nature.
No.
So it's going to be, but yeah. I can only think, and this I don't know, but I think that this must have sprung to them quickly. And they are a bit, they're often a bit quick off the mark. It's like, this has happened. This is important. We need to do it now. Boom. They were always rushing things.
Yeah.
Always like, we have an idea. It's going to be launched. And, you know, other brands will take 18 months from concept to get something out. Lush is like, okay, stability test. Boom. Out the door. And I think that's likely to have been what occurred. And probably they also like to be cheeky. They did seriously like to push it as far as they could go. And, you know, if somebody then issues them with a cease and desist, they'd cease and desist.
So I was going to say, what do you think are going to be the legal repercussions of this in your kind of professional opinion with your sort of knowledge of the industry? What do you think? Do you think that this is going to backfire on them, or do you think they're going to get away with it given the state that the, because the boss just appointed a new CEO, so they want a kind of new fresh start, and I imagine they're not going to really stand for sort of stunts like this moving forward.
Yeah, I think they've probably got bigger fish to fry, the new CEO of Body Shop at the moment. But okay, so Cost Lush is entirely, as they say, vertically integrated. They make everything. They design in-house. Everything's in-house. Or at least it was when I was there. They might have brought in external companies now, but pretty much everything's in-house. So they'll make a batch of something. If people didn't buy it, they wouldn't make another.
Yeah.
There are so many other things that they can do. So it's possible that they've made a statement expecting to get a cease and desist, at which point, don't make another batch. That's possible. It would not be unlike their thinking, I would say, to be, because they just, when they see an important, what they think is, like you say, an ethical issue, and in this case, it's, you took our good stuff and you've shut it down and now customers can't get it and that's not fair. That for them would be an ethical issue.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So like, if customers can't get it, you know, you've closed the company. It looked like the company was going to close. Okay, fine, it's being rescued. I mean, at one point, Mark considered buying the Body Shop and then changing its name to keep it fluffy. It's a long story, but they didn't eventually do it because it would have just been too much extra stress. But you know, that's how strongly they have felt about it in the past, that when it was sort of rumored to be for sale before L'Oreal bought it, Mark did go to the city and talk about getting backing and, you know, funding to buy the whole blinking Body Shop. So in order to get their formulas back.
Yeah, how would that have worked given that they're now a competitor? I guess, would it just be kind of to sort of absorb it under the Lush umbrella and then, like you say, just get the formulas back? As opposed,
honestly, they were going to rebrand all the shops and call them Keep It Fluffy. That was going to happen. Instead, they brought out a perfume called Keep It Fluffy when they launched Be Never Too Busy to Be Beautiful. But scrolling back even further to when I first met them, I was a cosmetics to go customer, and then that failed. And then they brought out a new brand, which then eventually turned into Lush. And I started working with them in 1996. So, but I think it was 94, maybe it all went wrong. Lush was that. That was 1992. So what happened was when they got all the money from Body Shop for buying out their formulas, they set up Cosmetics to Go. And it grew and grew and grew. It grew far too quickly. They couldn't keep track of the orders. They were making big mistakes. I was getting the wrong parcel, and lots of people were. And then they'd say, oh, don't worry, we'll send you another one. So I was thinking, this cannot last.
Best business
you
model.
Could see it must have been chaos down there. And sure enough, then what happened was there was a pipe burst, and they took out the computer system, and nobody knew who'd ordered what, and the whole thing. They had to call in the administrators, because they wanted to do it right. You know, they wanted to pay everyone that they owed, but the company just ceased trading Wallop. So that had happened. That really, really hurt them. And what's more, I think that somebody who used to work for them bought the rights to Cosmetics to Go and all the formulas. So they lost the rights they lost the trademark for bath bomb. They lost the rights to use a whole load of things that they'd invented, and they were really hurt. I interviewed Mark for a dissertation I was writing in 1995, and he was in pain talking about losing all their rights to their own work. So that had already happened to them once. And the absolute joy they had when they finally bought back that company and bought back the rights to all their brand names and all their products again. They built up Lush in the meantime, but then they reabsorbed Cosmetics to Go and brought back some of those. So there's history to this. There's a precedent. They've already lost a load of formulas and bought them back and reestablished them. They feel about their creative work like extra members of their family. And, you know, that sense of loss of their creative work is tangible, and it affects them. When you talk to Mark about these things, you can see that he's, you know, he would grieve the loss of the company and the formulas and all the creative work. So, and I'm not saying that I think any other company should or would have done this, but I can see that the passion they felt about their ownership of this, and if it were to be just lost and gone forever, then they'd want it back. And I suspect that they were halfway through to this when somebody said, oh, it's fine, we've got a new CEO, it's all going to be fine, they're not lost after all. And they'd already manufactured them, so they might as well put them in the shops. I think that's where it is. And also, take the publicity. They love a good headline. They love causing controversy. They love, you know, even all kinds of marvelous things have happened, even when I was there, that, you know, shops trashed by people who go hunting when they were, you know, started their anti-fox hunting campaign. They like to make statements.
You'd say they were kind of more of the original Mavericks, as opposed to, I mean, obviously the Body Shop were Maverick as well, but from what you've said, it sounds like Lush or like Mark Constantine created the blueprint for the kind of activism driven branding in the beauty industry that we see today.
Absolutely. I mean, there was this American Express ad that came out featuring Anita Roddick at one point, and about how she'd gone to Brazil to meet the women who grew the nuts. And Mark said, huh, furthest she ever went for Brazil nuts was Sainsbury's. Because, you know, it was, I mean, he did think it was sort of funny, but he just thought it was outrageous that she'd go, oh, yes, I feel passionately about going and visiting the indigenous communities. But she never did. And at least not until way after it was established in Amex Beta. Whereas Lush actually go out there and do visit the growers and buy directly from the growers and do really good things to make sure that communities are growing sustainably. And yeah,
Walked the walk, whereas there's a bit of greenwashing involved where the Body Shop was concerned.
Yes, I mean, I saw a Body Shop truck a long, long, long time ago that said on it, I mean, this is like the 80s probably, said, before you throw something away, remember there's no such place as away. And I remember that. And the things that they said, the things that they did, had a huge effect on the way the cosmetics industry changed. Now, yeah. I do think that a lot of that was driven by the people who are now Lush. And I think if it's looked at as just, oh, it's just another cosmetics company having a go at another cosmetics company, that's to misunderstand. And I mean, not very many people are aware of all of this. And most of the ones who are won't talk about it, either because they've signed an NDA when they left. Because I was never actually employed by Lush. I was technically freelance. So I never really joined and I never really left. Lush would probably talk about it. If you get hold of Mark Constantine, he'd probably tell you all there. But it's just not simple. It's not as simple as saying, oh, look, it's an IP issue. To them, I think the IP part of it's probably about 5% of the decision making. The passion about their formulas just disappearing forever.
I wanted to reclaim that ownership and the narrative around those formulas, I guess.
Yeah.
And
this practically gives me PTSD, you know. I've not really thought about being in those meetings for about 14 years. And it's like,
Well, providing it's not too triggering, what was it like working? Can you provide some insight into what Mark was like to work with and what it was like working there in those kind of early days?
Yeah, exhausting. Mark loves to be surrounded by a lot of people. He likes very high energy meetings, and I like quiet. Also, he's always very He was always very warm. So he'd come in, we'd just get a room just about right, and he'd fling open the windows. And I'd sit there absolutely freezing. Also, he'd like the meetings to start at 10, and I lived in Ealing there in Poole. And so I was always cold and tired at meetings. And he thought I wasn't interested, and I was just cold and tired. So with Lush, you kind of have to be, you have to be right in front of Mark and tell him exactly what you're doing in order to get the brownie points. So even though I was writing, you know, 60,000 words every 3 months, he somehow thought that got done in a fortnight, I think, but he didn't realize that I was working all the hours that God gives in order to try and get it finished, and liaising with the Canadians at midnight and the Japanese at 8 in the morning. And so the places, the people who succeed there stick very close to him and remember to tell him of all the great things they've done. Mm. And I was really quite bad at that. Although in the early days, he would call me a lot. You know, Sundays, I'd get a call. And they'd, right, I want to ask your opinion on this, this, this. And
Sunday.
So it was like very exciting. There were no boundaries.
I can imagine. Yeah. It's one of those like startup mentality where this is my baby and I've put everything into it. Therefore, it should be your baby as well. And you should be putting everything into it. And it's actually.
Yeah. I would say that for me, it changed when, I mean, Mark stopped calling the rest of us. There was a generation of like about my age that were kind of came in slightly younger than the founders, but older than their children. And once Mark and Mo brought their children into the business, they consulted them about everything. And some of us older ones were then mildly superfluous to requirement. So seeing the writing on the wall, I trained up some young people to do my role. And then I just kind of slid out. Mark liked this kind of gladiatorial, let's put people in competition with each other and see who does the best work. But what he'd done was he had employed people that he liked. And we all tended to like each other. And
so it didn't work, that kind of.
No, and so I get a phone call saying, like, oh, Mark's asked me to write the copy for the soapboards. Can we get together? Yeah, of course we can. And we get together, we write a new copy of the soapboards, and then we get to the meeting, and Mark's like, you're not supposed to do it together. You're supposed to compete. Because he'd read a business book, and he would give him some new ideas, and he'd say, right, I'll try that one. And so, but we kind of coagulated like oil on top of.
But collaboration is way more productive than competition, I think.
Well,
I think
that's what we all thought. We didn't really understand what was going on, why he got so angry when we'd actually all decided to work together. But then he put me in competition with one of his sons, and I could obviously see that that wasn't going to go well. So that was the point at which I decided, sort of quite kind of as quietly as I could, to train up other writers. I already had an international team by then. I needed a rest, you know. I'd done 14 years of it. I really needed a break. We moved house once, and the last thing to be moved out, there was nothing left in the house except me, the modem, the computer on the floor in one corner. And I was moved out, put into a car, driven to the new place. The modem, the computer, and I were plugged in as everybody else brought the stuff around, because I could not stop work for a day.
Yeah.
Because the Lush Times deadline was on. And
yeah, I've had jobs like that. I can completely sympathize. Yeah.
Yeah. And if you're not there, because I was in London and they were in Poole mostly, and they couldn't see me working, they didn't know it was happening, even though the words appeared by magic. So unfortunately, they just wore me out, you know. I don't like big noisy meetings full of lots of people.
I think that startup environment, it can be, sorry, carry on.
No, it's just that you're absolutely right. I agree with you. It is that. But they just got bigger and bigger. It was fine when it started off like 7 noisy people or in a room. I could cope, but it just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And
it's a common kind of thing that happens. Because I feel like that startup environment, it can be so exciting and dynamic. And like you say, it's all these people in a room with all these ideas and you're all like geared up. And then as a company gets bigger and bigger, it just gets, like you say, too noisy. And you're like, I have to take a step back. I can't cope with this. And obviously, the more people, the more politics there are.
I mean, I did some good stuff. I mean, I did the launch of Lush in Paris because I spoke French, so I did the press launch, which was, you know, you could be picked out for things that you can do, and like, hey, you do that. And Mark was very good at just if somebody expressed an interest in something, say, okay, you can do that, which I admire.
I love the Lush
But
Talk voice so much, and I feel like you kind of helped create that, or you did create that in a way, because like with the Lush Times, it was,
yeah.
I used to get it as a student. I loved it. I loved the kind of that way of talking about beauty, that beauty could be fun. It wasn't this kind
Yeah.
of very sophisticated, very austere kind of world that it had been in the past. It was, it was fun and quirky and irreverent. And I feel like, do you feel like you kind of helped build that tone of voice for him or for the brand?
Yeah, I do. I just, but I wanted it to be like, we eventually, I gave it a description, and I ran it past them and said, what do you think? You think we call it this when I'm explaining it to other people, when I'm teaching people overseas how to do it, because they'd all try to write like blinking L'Oreal. And oh, this gives you the glossiest, shiniest hair. With no, stop that. It's a friendly conversation with a customer who's asked you a question. That's the way I wanted everybody to write. This is how you write. Somebody's come in and said, oh, my hair's looking a bit shit. What should I do? It's like, oh, you want that one because your hair's a bit like this. So if your hair's like that, then you need this, and it's got that in it, and this and it, this and it, and it that'll fix it. It'll be great. So it was take that and put it on paper, and the staff used it as like training manual almost. They would write, oh, all right, I can say that. Let's see what the Lush Times says. And so it was. I'm actually smiling now that you've talked about this. I have a complete collection of the Lush Times from 1996. Christmas edition was the first one I did, right through to the first one in 2010. So I think I've got the only complete collection. I was going to give it to the Lush Archive, but they were going to send a van to collect it, and they never did. So I've got four boxes sitting in my front room, but maybe I'll keep them. But yes, it was great to do. It was great to do,
It
but
shows the importance of tone of voice when it comes to a brand's success. Because I think a lot of the Lush, success, all like the products are great and they pioneered so many different things. But I think the tone of voice is like a key component of why Lush is the sort of iconic brand it is today.
yeah, putting it into Italian was quite interesting as well, because they didn't we used lots and lots of adjectives, and there's all these like, oh no, you shouldn't be using adverbs and you shouldn't be using adjectives, like put them all in. I was told by a teacher once they used to use the Lush Times to show their students how to use adverbs, like get in. Yeah,
Amazing.
because Stephen King says cut them all out, like nah, put them all in.
Wrong with an advert,
So
but
yeah, that yes, I'm not comparing myself with Stephen King. You understand this. It was
why
we
not?
had different reasons. Well, he was trying to he was writing fiction, and I was selling bath bombs. So you know, but I think adverbs have their place, especially if they're surprising ones. I don't want to get too technical now, but no, it was I mean, it was very gossipy. That's the only thing about it. Mark loved hearing bad things about people. You know, naughty things about people. And people would make shit up. And I used to spend quite a lot of my time, no, that's not what happened. I was there and it didn't happen. That's not fair. With the head of press kind of trying to give me a stare to say, shut up, don't argue with him. He doesn't want to be argued with. So I got a bit of a reputation for being contrary. But that was well deserved. I am.
Yeah, and
Yeah.
given the spirit of Lush and the fact that they are a contrary brand, I'm sure that that would have been very welcome to an
I think
extent.
I had a place. I had a place. But yeah, I did. I really liked getting. I'm still friends, you know, with a lot of the customers that I met on the Lush Forum was one of the first like internet places you could go and chat about stuff. And because I was Auntie Pamela who wrote the problem page, I was on the forum as Auntie Pamela. So yeah, I still see people around the world sometimes. I met somebody last week and I said, oh yeah, I was Auntie Pamela. She went, oh my God, no, you're Auntie Pamela. Like, yeah. And it's like, oh, I used to read it when I was at school. I'm going, yeah, right, thanks for that. Yeah.
But it sounds like you have
no, it's a
some
big.
fond memories, even though it was
Yeah.
obviously a very complicated place and marks a very complicated, creative genius. But that comes
Yeah.
with its problems, like if you're dealing with that day in, day out.
Yeah.
But it
But
sounds like
he.
you have really nice kind of memories.
Yeah, I mean it takes a while to explain, as we know now. It takes a while to explain the 40-year history of what brought it to the point where they felt that they needed to do this because it's the right thing to do. And by without a shadow of a doubt, this is done because Mark thinks it is the right thing. And also probably a bit naughty.
So it's kind of saving those formulas rather than just letting them die out with the other company.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think had Body Shop not looked like it was about to disappear off the face of the planet, I don't think they would have done it. And I think it probably just didn't disappear in the middle of what they were planning. And so in which case they thought, well, in that case, let's make a big fuss about it because there'll
Yeah.
probably be a cease and desist. I mean, I've lived through many cease and desists at Lush. I was on in the room. He allowed us to be in the room. He put the phone on speaker when Sir Alan Sugar bollocked him about putting a cartoon in the shop window that looked an awful lot like him.
Oh, I would love to have been a fly on the wall in that.
Oh God, that was funny. He's just like we were trying hard not to laugh because,
It like an
yeah, I
episode of The
mean.
Apprentice where he's bollocking them in the boardroom? Was it kind of like
Yeah, it was. Well, what had happened is there'd been an episode of The Apprentice, and they'd all made some really terrible products. So Mark invited his own team into the labs, and they'd gone down to Lush and film. And Mark thought they were so uninspired. He got his own people. Anyone who wanted to go and join a team and work in the labs could invent their own product. And one of them made one called the Sugar Scrub. And my headline was, "Sugar's never been this good for your figures," because they're people. I was proud of that.
Yeah, that's a good
Or,
one. That's a zinger.
thank you. The people on the show had all lost money because they'd mixed up sandalwood and cedarwood. And so in the window, Hannah Diamond had, she was a very talented illustrator. She drew a picture of somebody sugar scrubbing their ass, and tattooed on the ass was somebody who looks possibly a bit like Alan Sugar. And so there in all the shop windows, it says, "Sugar's never been this good for your figures," and it's people having a nice scrub with a sugar scrub. I think actually he called it Sir Alan, which might have possibly been the problem. And so you got Mark going, "Oh, well, it was just a bit of fun," and you could hear screaming down the other end, "Have fun." So yeah, good times. They've never been afraid of a bit of controversy.
No, that's very clear. And when it comes to the Body Shop, what do you think, just quickly, what do you think the future is for them and Anita Roddick's kind of legacy? Because her legacy seems very ambiguous. Some people were still saying she sold out, whereas I think what she built was incredible with the Body Shop, and I really think she should get her credit for that. But where do you
Yeah.
see the kind of the future of the Body Shop now, especially in light of what Lush have done?
I haven't been in one for about 25 years. I don't really care. I think if she sold out, she didn't mean to sell out. She thought she was climbing up the ladder of saving more animals. She thought she was getting into a place where that she was really going to make a huge difference, end animal cruelty and end the testing once and
You
for
also made a
all.
huge ton of money in the process, obviously.
Yeah, this is true. Although the man she sold one third of the business to made the most, I think, way back when Gordon went on his finding himself mission. He went away for a year, and she sold a third of the business to fund some expansion. And the guy who owned, I think he owned their garage in Brighton or something. He I think he did best out of it. But yeah, if somebody gets hold of it again and chooses to use it as a tool for good, again, that'd be great.
Yeah.
I think that's what distressed Mark most, is it was being used as a tool for profit generation, as you know, most businesses that size are, and it could have been better. Yeah. I think that's what it's all about. Do I mind if Body Shop stays or goes? I mean, I don't know. I want it to stand for something. I want it to change the world again. That's what I hope.
And for me, it's like that nostalgia, because it was the sort of one of the first places I would shop for beauty. So I have those childhood memories of, like, as many people do, of like White Musk and Jubilee and all of that. So for me, there's a sentimental aspect that I would like to see it carry on, or maybe carry Christmas on through basket. Lush.
You remember the little baskets you could fill up with?
Yes. Stuff for Christmas? Oh my gosh, that memory unlocked. Those were like my favorite thing to do.
I got everybody one of those one Christmas. Everybody I knew got a basket full of Body Shop stuff. Yeah, we've all got memories, I think, of them.
I think the year I turned 12 and people stopped getting me toys, I just got Body Shop baskets, because I think relatives were like, what do we get a 12-year-old? So I got about like 10 different Body Shop baskets that year, because I was like, 12 for Barbie, so let's just get one of these. And everyone had the same idea. But
those weird pearls that look great, and that you put them in the bathroom, left them for a while, and they turned into a pile of sludge.
Yeah, those. But then they're all left with these weird like skins.
Before the EU brought in stability testing.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Sarah, thank you so much for chatting with me. I know you're very busy, so I won't take up any more of your time. But thank you so much for your insights. It's been really interesting, and I think gives more of a nuanced perspective on the situation that I think a lot of people will appreciate. So thank you so much, and looking forward to having you possibly on the podcast again at some stage, because
fingers crossed. I think I need to lie down a cup of tea now, but otherwise it's been a delight.
Great stuff, and I'll let you go and do that. Thanks again, Sarah. Take care.
Bye, Layla.
I hope you enjoyed that episode. All links will be in the show notes, and feel free to visit smartbeautycreative.com or visit us over on Instagram to find out more about what we do. And if you enjoyed listening, please don't forget to rate and review Smart Beauty on iTunes, as it helps people find us. See you next time.